If you're new or you just missed the last couple weeks, we've been talking lately about the Bible and what is the big story of the Bible. And last week in particular, in 1 week, we talked about the story of the Bible from cover to cover, didn't we, if you were here? Didn't we? Yes. We had a great time. So let me see if I can briefly review that, and then we're going to jump into a kind of a subtopic today. We talked last week about the fact that there is a core story in the Bible. Now, the Bible contains all kinds of stories, thousands of them, but they all unite and they all tie around one particular story. And you can boil that story down into four words: creation, fall, redemption, and restoration. We talked about the fact that God originally created the world good and a place that was perfect, a place where everything was as it is supposed to be. No heartache, no pain, no struggle, no difficulty, no disease, and no inflicting hurt on one another. And then there was something that theologians call the fall. Fall is when humanity chose to, instead of following God in His way, to go their own way. And the result of that is everything cataclysmic that happens in our lives individually and that happens in the world at large. That's when we could say the world broke and sin entered the world and we fell from the path, the way, the good thing that God desired for every one of us. And so that's the story of the first man and woman that were created, Adam and Eve. It's also the story of our lives. And so it is why we do the things that we do that hurt people and why they do things that hurt us. And that was the fall. And God had every right at that point to say, I'm done. I rid my hands of you and I am stepping away. But graciously, He didn't do that. He chose to send Jesus. And that's where the story of redemption comes in. Redemption means to buy back. And God sent Jesus to live a perfect life and die a sacrificial death in our place. And because He lived a perfect life, He could do that. He could be our substitute. And so up to this day, if you are someone who turns your life over to God, then in exchange for your sin, you receive God's, Jesus' right standing before God. So there's a substitute that takes place. And then everything in history is ultimately moving towards what? Do you remember? Restoration. Restoration is the putting back of everything that's broken. It's making everything whole and complete again. And we read in the last chapter of the Bible how God says there'll be a day when there'll be no more tears, no more pain, no more heartache, no more sin, that everything will be made new. And so there's this great, humongous thing that God is working right now in the world. And it happens both individually in our lives as we jump onto God's team, but it's also this great, humongous plan that God's working out in all the universe. So that is the grand story that all of history is working towards. And that is your story. Somewhere you fit into that story. Creation, fall, redemption, restoration. And we looked at also what the word gospel means. The gospel is the core message of Scripture. And we define the gospel as the power of God to save. And we looked at how that relates to that story of creation, fall, redemption, restoration. So that's where we've been so far. Now here's the thing that is what we're going to consider today. I'm not sure we can really understand or appreciate the gospel, the good news of God's power to save, unless we know the bad news. We can't really appreciate and live in light of the fact that there's good news unless we know how bad the bad news really is. So guess what we get to do today? We're going to be encouraged. We're going to consider the horrible news. Okay? How's that sound? All right. Everybody's fired up about that. All right. If you would, for a minute, turn to your neighbor, somebody sitting near you, and I want you to tell them the very first thing that comes in your mind when you hear this word. Okay? Will you do that for me? Yeah? Okay. Thank you, Joni. There's one. When you hear the word sin, what what do you think of? What comes to mind? All right, take a second and share with somebody around you what you think of. All right. Good job. Thank you. What'd you come up with? Bad? Just bad. Just bad. Okay. What else? Satan? Okay. What else? Death? Darkness? Separation? What? Deception? Disobedience? Yucky? Okay? Is that generally what everybody came up with? Anything we haven't looked at? Forgiveness? Interesting. Good. Shame? Where you go when you sin? Okay. A lot of what you've said, I think, fits into basically this box. That there's a list of rules. And you either keep them or you don't. And to not keep them is sin. And generally, perhaps we could say for many of us, our conception of God is this heavenly cosmic cop, all right? And he's come up with a list of do's and don'ts. And if you fail to do what he says, then you've sinned. Or if you've done what he says to not do, then you've sinned. And that ushers in much of what you've talked about. So could we agree that maybe generally that's the image that we come up with? Okay. I want to give you a completely different way of considering sin, of looking at what it is. Not that that's incorrect, because it is correct. But if we had a pie, we just considered one slice of it. And unfortunately, what the church often does is we major on rules and we shove people out and we feel good about ourselves if we keep them, bad about ourselves if we don't, and we don't look at what the deeper issue is with sin. And so today we're going to peel back that onion a little bit and we're going to look at what sin is at a deeper level. And I'm going to give you some terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day news. All right? Okay, so we're all going to be encouraged by that. If you have a Bible, look at Numbers chapter 11. Now, I know you all woke up at 5 a.m. to read Numbers today. And you've already covered this, but just humor me and look again. All right? Numbers chapter 11. It goes Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers. Okay? Numbers chapter 11. And we're going to look at a fascinating story, two of them, and I think we're going to have a great time together. Okay? Numbers chapter 11. Here we go. Let's roll. Then the foreign rabble who were traveling with the Israelites. Isn't that beautiful? The foreign rabble. I find that humorous. You don't, obviously. Then the foreign rabble who were traveling with the Israelites began to crave the good things of Egypt. And the people of Israel also began to complain. Oh, for some meat, they exclaimed. How many of you have ever said that? All right. I have never in my entire life, I think, said that. I'm just saying. We remember the fish we used to eat for free in Egypt. And we had all the cucumbers and the melons and the leeks and the onions and the garlic we wanted. But now our appetites are gone. All we ever see is this stinking manna. All right, what's going on here? Here's the story, if I could bring you up to speed real quick. If you've never heard any of this before, I'm sure this sounds really bizarre. God went to a man named Abram and said to him, I want you to go to this place and I'm going to create a new people group through your descendants. And those descendants are going to become the Israelites. And I'm going to give you a special place to live. And through those descendants, all the nations, all the people groups of the earth are going to be blessed. And ultimately, we know that that was a proclamation of the gospel, and that the gospel would spread to all the people groups of the planet. Okay, so this is the very early on in the story of the Bible. This is not long after the fall. And if we look at creation, fall, redemption, restoration. So now let's fast forward a whole bunch of years, and you've got now this people group. You've got the Israelites. And they were in Egypt, and now they are en route to the promised land. They're en route to Israel. And they're wandering around out in the desert. They didn't have any food, so God miraculously provided this substance called manna for them. Apparently it fell from the sky. I know it sounds weird, but that's the way the story goes. And they would make raisin manna cakes, and that's what they ate every day. And apparently they started griping about the manna cakes. They didn't like these any longer. What did they want? They wanted meat. All right? Now, if you could choose any meat, what would you choose? One, two, three, you can yell it. All right? One, two, hey! One, two, three.
Steak.
I think steak won. I heard goat. All right, so that's what they wanted. They wanted meat. Okay? Now, they used the word crave. That they craved meat. What does it mean to crave for something? Okay. Really, really, really want it. It refers to a lust. It refers to a longing for something in a really significant way. So the desire for this meat was really, really strong, apparently. To deeply crave something is to become so enthralled by the desire for it that you want it so bad you don't really even consider what could be the consequence if I get it. Okay? You want it so bad that you sort of lose sight of what you're saying and what you're thinking. Now notice this. In verse 4 it says, "Oh, for some meat! We remember the fish we used to eat for free in Egypt." Okay, now somebody help me out. Why is that an incredibly stupid thing to say? Okay, why was the meat free? They were slaves. They lived in Egypt as indentured servants. They had no money. Not a dollar. Nothing. So, why would they have been fed? So they could work 12, 13, 14 hour days the next day. Okay? They were worked literally near death, so they needed protein, so they apparently gave them lots and lots and lots of meat. So, look at how illogical this is. If you know the story, God had miraculously taken them out of Egypt. Done things that only a God could do. Only supernatural things could get them out of Egypt. And that's what happened. And now they're looking back and saying, we want to go back. We want meat so bad. This is so terrible. Out here in the desert eating this bread, that we want to go back there. We want to be slaves again so we can have the food we like. Isn't that stupid? It's incredibly stupid. I just find it astonishing. Now, it is as though their cravings crossed this line into irresponsibility and irrationality. Right? Who does that hurt? When we do that, or when they did that, let's just start with that. When they crossed this line from, we're not happy with what we have, we want something else, who was that hurting? It was hurting them, wasn't it? Very significantly. So much so that they were in inner turmoil, wanting to go back and be slaves again. But I think it also hurt God. And we'll come back to that idea. Now look at how their leader, Moses, responds. All right, verse 10. Moses heard all the family standing in the doorway of their tents, whining. And the Lord became extremely angry. Moses was also very aggravated. Moses said to the Lord, "Why are you treating me, your servant, so harshly? Have mercy on me. What did I do to deserve the burden of these people? Did I give birth to them? Did I bring them into the world? Why did you tell me to carry them in my arms like a mother carries a nursing baby? How can I carry them to the land you swore to give their ancestors? Where am I supposed to get meat for all these people? They keep whining to me saying, 'Give us meat!' I can't carry these people by myself. The load is far too heavy. If this is how you intend to treat me, just go ahead and kill me. Do me a favor and spare me this misery." When you picture Moses, is that how you think of him? These people were bellyaching, whining, complaining so much that he said to God, "God, just kill me. God, I'm done. I want nothing more to do with these idiots." That's what he said. Now, check out God's response. Verse 18. "And say," this is God now. God's telling them what to say. "Say to the people, 'Purify yourselves, for tomorrow you will eat meat. You were whining, and the Lord heard you when you cried, 'Oh, for some meat! We were better off in Egypt.' Now the Lord will give you meat, and you will have it to eat. But it won't just be for a day or two, or even 5 or 10 or even 20. You'll eat it for a whole month, until you gag, and you're sick of it." Okay, now let's think through this. What was God's response to their whining and complaining and bellyaching? He gave them what they wanted, right? Okay, now I'll tell you the rest of the story in a minute. But here he's telling Moses, "Go tell them, you're going to get meat. You're going to get a lot of it. In fact, throw a party. It's going to be a meat kegger for a whole month." All right? Now, I believe this is both judgment or discipline and mercy. God giving them what they wanted was both discipline and mercy. Now, how can that be? How can the same action do both? Well, think of it in your own life. Are there times that God gives you what you want, even if it's not necessarily the best thing for you? In one way, that's sort of letting you go your own way and disciplining you by giving you what you wanted, because He knows that you need that experience in order to learn. And in that way, it's also an act of mercy, because it's saying, "You don't realize what you can have in me, through me. So mercifully, I'm going to grant you your request, even though it's going to be harmful for you." So I think the very same action can be both discipline and mercy. And it was in this case. So, let's see what takes place. And let's think about what sin is. Get back to the original question I asked you. On the one hand, sin is just disobeying God's commands. It's this box of do this, don't do this, and when you break it, that's sin. But on another level, it's something much deeper. And if you don't get anything else today, I hope you'll get this. On another level, on a deeper level, sin is a rejection of God. Sin is a pushing away of God Himself. Now let me show you this from the story. Look at verse 20. "You will eat it for a whole month until you gag and you're sick of it, for you have rejected the Lord. Who is here among you? You have whined to Him saying, 'Why did we ever leave Egypt?'" Now, do you see how their craving, their irrational desire for meat was a rejection of God. Does that make sense? Let's put it in our language and see if it'll help. When you crave and then gaze at porn, you're rejecting God. It's not just that there's these rules and you're breaking one. It's that you're rejecting God Himself. You're saying, God, you don't satisfy. You're not enough. I have to get pleasure somewhere else. When you gossip about somebody to make yourself look better, that's not just breaking a box with rules in it. It's rejecting God. It's saying, God, what other people think about me is more important than what you think. So I'm pushing you away. When you refuse to share the gospel with somebody on your dorm room or in your apartment complex or at the cubicle across from you at work, that's not just rejecting this little rule. It's rejecting God. It's saying, God, what you died for is less important to me than possibly losing a relationship. It's shoving God away. When you spend all your money on yourself and don't care for other people in need, don't share what you have with others, don't care for whatever caused them the injustice that they're in, that's rejecting God. That's saying, God, what you provided for me isn't enough. You've mistreated me, so I have to hoard everything I have. When you're envious over what others have that you don't have, or over the life that you live compared to the life that they live, that's rejecting God. That's saying, God, you failed me. You have dealt me a bad life, and so I push you away. If you still struggle with guilt or shame or pride, and you turn to anything else but Jesus to meet those needs, that's a rejection of God. Do you see that? Let's say you turn to food for comfort instead of God. Then what are you saying? You're saying, God, you're not enough. I have to seek comfort somewhere else. Now, does that hurt you? Sure, in that case, it hurts your health significantly. But ultimately, more importantly, it hurts God. Because it's a rejection of God. Now, let me make that even clearer. Sin is much, much, much deeper than disobeying a command. Ultimately, it's choosing to love something more than you love God. Don't turn there, but let me show you this from another story, okay? Just listen to this. This is from Jeremiah. The Lord gave me another message. He said, go and shout this message in Jerusalem. This is what the Lord says. I remember how eager you were to please me as a young bride long ago, how you loved me and followed me, even through the barren wilderness. In those days, Israel was holy to the Lord, the first of his children. All who harmed his people were declared guilty. Disaster fell on them. I am the Lord who has spoken. Take off your churchy glasses for a minute. What kind of language is that? How is he framing this discussion, particularly at the beginning of that section? He's framing it in a marriage relationship. And not just marriage in general, but what kind of marriage? A new marriage. A hot, steamy marriage. Right? He's describing the relationship in sexual language. Do you see it? Let me read it again to you so you see it. Verse 2. Go and shout this message. This is what the Lord says. I remember how eager you were to please me as a young bride long ago. He's saying, you used to desire me like a new bride desires to please her husband sexually. That messes with your concept of God, doesn't it? He's not saying you wanted to sleep with me. He's saying the same kind of passion that a bride has for her new husband, you had for me. But what happened? Now, let's read on. Verse 4. Listen to what the Lord says. People of Jacob, all you families of Israel. What did your ancestors find wrong with me that led them out astray so far from me? They worshipped worthless idols, only to become worthless themselves. They didn't ask, where is the Lord who brought us safely out of Egypt and led us through the barren wilderness, land of deserts and pits, drought and death, where no one lives or even travels? When I brought you into the fruitful land to enjoy its bounty and goodness, you defiled my land. You corrupted the possessions I promised you. The priest didn't ask, where's the Lord? Those who taught my word ignored me. The rulers turned against me. The prophets spoke in the name of Baal, wasting their treasures on worthless idols. Has any nation ever traded its gods for a new one, even though they were not gods at all? Yet my people have exchanged the glorious gods for worthless idols. Your wickedness will bring its own punishment. Your turning from me will bring shame on you. You will see what an evil, bitter thing it is to abandon the Lord your God and not to fear him. There it is again. Sin is an abandonment, a rejection, a pushing away of God. It's not just breaking a rule. Verse 20, long ago I broke the yoke that oppressed you and tore away the chains of your slavery. But still you said, I will not serve you. On every hill and under every green tree, you have prostituted yourselves by bowing down to idols. You say, that is not true. I've not worshipped the images of Baal. But how can you say that? Go and look in the valley and the land. Face the awful sins you have done. You are like a restless female camel, desperately searching for a mate. You are like a wild donkey, sniffing the wind at mating time. Who can restrain her lust? Those who desire her don't need to search, for she goes running to them. When will you stop running? When will you stop panting after other gods? Now, this is a shocking, shocking message, but extremely, extremely helpful. Littered all through this passage is sexual imagery. But it's not talking about sexual sin at all. It's talking about sin in general. We see from this passage that sin is breaking the heart of God. God is not a cosmic cop that sits up in heaven with a big ruler. And he's just waiting for you to break one of the rules in his little box so he can swat you. God here is picturing himself as a husband that's been what? Cheated on. God is picturing himself as a spouse that's been abandoned. God is picturing himself as the recipient of an adulterous relationship. Now look again at verse 20. Long ago I broke the yoke that oppressed you and tore away the chains of your slavery, but still you said, I will not serve you. On every hill and under every green tree, you have prostituted yourselves by bowing down to idols. Now, we'd expect it to say, on every hill and under every green tree, you've worshipped idols, right? An idol is just anything that you place in priority above God. It doesn't have to be a totem pole looking thing that you actually bow down to. It can just be anything that's more important to you than God is. So that's what we'd expect it to say. But that's not what it says. The ESV says it this way. Yes, on every high hill and under every green tree, you bowed down like a whore. Now, here's the graphic picture that it's actually giving us. I bet if we went around and took every Bible translation that is represented here, none of them would actually say what the Hebrew says. What it says is, under every tree and in every grassy field, you spread your legs. That's what it actually says. So what's the imagery? The imagery is that when we sin, we push the perfect husband away. And spiritually, we climb in bed with something else. That could be anything. And we spread our legs, and we're just as vulnerable spiritually in that moment as you are physically when you're having sex. Do you see how dramatically different this is than the cosmic cop with a big ruler just waiting to swat you? This is God saying, when you sin, you break my heart. When you sin, you become a slut to some other thing that will love you and then leave you. Have you ever thought of sin like that? Have you ever thought of sin as a shoving away of the one that's given you every good thing that you have? Every good thing that you have. And then you climbed in bed with it, whatever it is. You spread your legs. And you open yourself up in that most vulnerable of all positions to something that can never, ever satisfy. That, my friend, is what sin is. Some of you have experienced the most painful, I think, thing that happens humanly in relationships. You've had a spouse that has slept around on you. And you've wound up perhaps divorced or maybe not. But you know the pain, the deeply, intensely, no really words to describe, the rejection, the defecation that occurs. Do you know who else feels that way? God does. And God does by what every single one of us have done spiritually. So sin is so much more than a breaking of rules. Sin is a rejection of the one who loves us with an unending, undying, completely perfect, unconditional love. And sin is a spreading of our legs to worthless things that could never satisfy. Now let's go back to the other story real quick. We want meat! So what does God do? He gives them meat. And meat comes down for a month. And they eat so much meat that some of them die. Okay? Physically, they were used to eating bread. They get so much meat that they gorge themselves. Have you ever thought you were going to die after Thanksgiving? Okay? Imagine Thanksgiving every meal, three times a day, for a month. That's what they had. And it says that they named the place Kibbereth Hatava, which means graves of gluttony. They literally named this physical location after the people that died. Now that's a downer. That's a sad story. But that is the story of what sin leads us into. It ultimately leads us into the grave of gluttony, where we get what we asked for. But the great story of all time is not creation, not the fall, but redemption and restoration. God, in His grace, is the rejected husband that's standing there seeing everything we're doing and says, I welcome you back with open arms if you'll just return. And that is the gospel. The gospel is, I love you in spite of what you've done. You can never earn a fix to this adultery that you've committed. But if you'll simply come to me, I will forgive. And you can be in my arms again with a perfect love. Isn't that beautiful? That is the gospel. No matter what you've done, no matter what you've slept with, Jesus welcomes you back. And He heals and mends that relationship with the Father. That, my friends, is the good news. That is the great news. So that we don't have to live in that junk. Now, I hope that gives you a deeper, fuller expression of what it means that there is a good news of the power of God.